I am extremely happy to welcome Jemima Pierre at ECAS6 on behalf of the scientific and organization committees. Jemima Pierre is associate professor at the Department of African American Studies and at the Department of Anthropology at the University of California, Los Angeles. Jemima is a sociocultural anthropologist whose research and teaching interests are located in the overlaps between African studies and African diaspora studies. Her main research topics are race and racial formation theory, culture and the history of anthropology theory, and transnationalism, globalization, and diaspora. She is the author of The Predicament of Blackness, Postcolonial Ghana, and the Politics of Race, winner of the 2014 Elliott Skinner Book Award in Africanist Anthropology. And she is currently completing a manuscript whose working title is Racial Americanization, Conceptualizing African Immigrants in the U.S. She is also working on a project on the racialized political economy of multinational resource extraction in Ghana. And before giving the floor to Jemima, I would like to stress how difficult I think it must be to question race and racism both in Africa and in the African diaspora. The title of the conference is Pan-Africanism, Decolonization, and the Black Radical Tradition.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for taking the time to come here and listen. And I'd like to thank the organizers in particular for inviting me and giving me the honor to present my work to you here. Thank you. These are traumatic times for African peoples. In the past years alone, we have witnessed a cascading set of tragic events afflicting African peoples on the continent and worldwide. The Garissa attacks in Kenya that claimed the lives of 147 young students, the ongoing slaughter of Nigerians by Boko Haram, the sudden Ebola epidemic that ravaged Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, killing 11,193 people, including a large number of African doctors and healthcare workers. Closer to Europe, the deaths of over 700 would-be African migrants off the coast of Libya, added to the thousands of African lives lost to the Mediterranean Sea. There's also the virulent ethnic cleansing of Black Libyans, casualties of both anti-Black racism in Northern Africa and Europe, and NATO's cynical appropriation of the momentum of the Arab Spring. In all of this, however, the world's general response, with exceptions, reminds us that there is, on the one hand, a normalization of African death and suffering, and perhaps paradoxically, on the other hand, a fetishization of African death and suffering. Note, for example, the Western media's unabashed pleasure in repeatedly published photographs of dead and decaying bodies of Africans, or more importantly, consider the disparate global response to the killing of the 12 Charlie Hebdo satirists to that of the 147 Kenyan students massacred, or the blatant racial bias in the treatment of Africans and non-Africans infected with Ebola virus, as infected non-Africans were given experimental drugs and flown to the US or Europe, while Africans, including African doctors and aid workers, were left to die from the disease. Worse still is the inability or refusal to make the connections that both link these events of crisis and that also recognize that the general responses to them, to African crisis, is overdetermined by Africa's alterity, and in particular, its Blackness. To make these connections would be to acknowledge that in the general scheme of things, Black lives, African lives don't matter. It would also be to take stock of the global reality of the precarity of Black experience, to link the ongoing trauma of Lampedusa, for example, to the more than 250,000 Dominicans denationalized by the Dominican Republic because they're Black or of Haitian descent, and to anti-Black state terror and vigilante violence across Africa, Europe, the Middle East, and the Americas. These events are not isolated, of course. They are the product of a linked set of processes, wars of domination, colonialism, enslavement, dispossession, and genocide, in their various articulations. But there is something about this current historical moment that makes it difficult for a type of analysis that allows for, first, the exploration of a broad and global anti-Blackness undergirding the current predicament of African peoples on the continent, and second, the kind of collective mobilization that such a predicament necessitates. This is both an intellectual and political problem. On the one hand, post-colonial scholarship on Africa is configured in ways that often does not acknowledge the continuing impact of race and power on the continent and its dealings with the modern world. As such, the racialist structures that determine Africa's relationship to the world, political, social, economic, and cultural, continue to remain unexamined. On the other hand, is the political problem. The process of decolonization in Africa actually reinforced the scaffolding of white supremacy and racial capitalism beneath the veneer of Black political empowerment. This depended, of course, on a number of key compromises by nationalist leaders who assumed the supremacy of political power and who jettisoned prematurely, I believe, the Pan-Africanist critiques of imperialism and white supremacy, and most importantly, Pan-Africanism's project of liberation. What do these claims mean for our deliberations over the last few days on collective mobilizations across the African continent? I want to argue that while there has been a productive growth in protests across the African continent, the potential for sustained, broad, collective, and progressive mobilization is limited by both structural and intellectual impediments. The structural impediments are well known. Post-colonial states are neo-colonial and neoliberal states. They are this way by design. Let's remember that most of the more radical leaders of African decolonization, critics of European imperialism, were deposed and or killed with the directive or sanction of US and former colonial powers, while others were co-opted. But I also want to stress that the neo-colonial social, political, and economic relations of these states reflect Africa's racialized post-colonial predicament, and it is this predicament that deserves our acknowledgement and attention if there is to be a new politics of liberation. I will use the rest of my presentation to expand on these points. The discussion will unfold in two parts. First, using insights from my ongoing ethnographic and historical research in Ghana and West Africa more broadly, I briefly reconsidered the deployment and transformation of Pan-Africanism through a discussion of the racial and cultural dynamics that emerged from the social, political, and economic relations between the former colonial government and the new independent state. The Ghanaian case is particularly instructive because of its storied position in the history of Pan-Africanism. But this case can also serve as a broader template for understanding the dynamics of race and power in the African post-colony. The second part of the presentation reconsiders the project of decolonization as not one of success, but as one of general failure. I do this by recalling the theory and ideology of early Pan-Africanism as part of a broader Black radical tradition, as a set of ideas and practices that reconstructs philosophical and political connections across the rupturing history of global Black dispossession and disenfranchisement. The Black radical tradition may provide the best route to mobilization in the context of this current moment. My ultimate goal, therefore, is to deploy this historical and intellectual context to both retrace a particular anti-imperialism and to invoke a new paradigm, a new program of African liberation. Part 1. Hidden in the exclusive countermeasures neighborhood in Accra, Ghana, is the W.E.B. Du Bois Memorial Center for Pan-Africanism, Pan-African Culture. The Memorial Center is located in the house where W.E.B. Du Bois spent his final 2 years of life, and serves as a contemporary site of pilgrimage for scholars, artists, tourists, and students from all over the world. While the Ghanaian government, under its first president, Kwame Nkrumah, had given Du Bois a state funeral, his body was reinterred and his legacy memorialized in 1985 in another official state ceremony. This was followed in 1992 by the burial of Trinidadian Pan-Africanist George Padmore and the renaming of a memorial library in his honor, as well as the construction of a memorial park and the reinterment of Kwame Nkrumah, all undertaken under the leadership of then-dictator Flight Lieutenant Jerry John Rawlings. The establishment of public memorials in honor of those who are often called Ghana's quote, illustrious sons serves to reaffirm the country's position as a symbolic center of Pan-African politics. But the political and ideological production underlying the state's self-conscious recuperation of Ghana's legacy of Pan-Africanism raises important questions about the effectiveness of the project of Pan-Africanism in the post-colonial era. In Ghana, Nkrumah's popularity waned after the 1966 coup d'etat, but resurged in the late 1980s with Rawlings' military government. Rawlings was able to capitalize on Nkrumah's Pan-African rhetoric, deploying it against the national political malaise spawned by the realities of economic underdevelopment and policies of rapid liberalization. I contend, however, that Pan-Africanism worked in similar ways, for Nkrumah. While he genuinely believed in African progress and self-determination and the role of his new state in the fight for continental freedom, Nkrumah's Pan-African rhetoric ultimately obscured the reality that Ghana's nationalist ambitions were severely constricted by the predicament of post-colonialism, an underdeveloped and bifurcated polity within the context of unequal and white supremacist global political economy. While I am by no means equating the political position and vision of these two figures, Nkrumah and Rawlings, I am suggesting that in the deployment of Pan-Africanism, they reveal its extraordinary contradictions and limitations. As such, Ghana's historical experience with Pan-Africanism in the post-colonial moment may offer important lessons for those who are still invested in this broad emancipatory project. Because Ghana's independence offered symbolic racial redemption for Black populations worldwide, diaspora Blacks flocked to the country after independence. The important examples here are George Padmore and Black American W.E.B. Du Bois. While in London, Nkrumah worked with Padmore to organize the 5th Pan-African Congress in Manchester, England in 1945. It was at the Congress that Nkrumah became close to Du Bois, and he would later bestow Ghanaian citizenship on him in his waning years. On the ground in Ghana, Pan-Africanist ideology was given practical form in the Nkrumah government's foreign interactions. It hosted conferences that promoted an agenda for continental unity, established the Bureau of African Affairs to monitor and aid in emerging anti-colonial uprisings, and set up a National Security Council that was responsible for the military aspects of Pan-Africanism, including training camps for freedom fighters, asylum to refugees from South Africa and Portuguese Africa, and education for students across the continent. Of course, this is a well-rehearsed story, but I want to highlight some key moments in the making of the new post-colonial state that have been generally neglected, the structural and racial counterpoints to the ideological Pan-Africanism. Indeed, it is to the credit of Nkrumah and other Ghanaian administrations that since Jerry John Rawlings have held on, that other administrations have held on to the narrative of the nation's identity as emerging from a radical humanism and at times socialist Pan-Africanism. But how does this view of the nation's Pan-Africanism reconcile with the political economic realities on the ground at the formation of the new nation? Mahmoud Mamdani points out that contrary to conventional belief, apartheid was, in fact, the generic form of the colonial state in Africa. In other words, neither institutional segregation nor apartheid was a South African invention. Instead, these racially inscribed policies were the projection of British indirect rule that depended on native or tribal, as both identities and institutions from European ones, on separating native identities from European ones. Thus in Ghana and elsewhere, the significance of indirect rule was the fact that its power was concealed within the structure of local native authorities, rendering the white racial dominance and colonial power not only almost invisible, but hidden beneath local identities arranged and arranged in deep tribal. But arguably, the most far-reaching consequence of formal colonialism and racialized indirect rule was the near complete control of the Gold Coast emerging economy and its trading European relations by European firms. As early entrepreneurs and agents, Africans were integral to this expansion. However, throughout the colonial years, European companies, particularly banks, shipping, and extractive companies, joined forces to monopolize the Gold Coast economy. This was done, of course, with the explicit political and military support or military threat of the colonial government. Except for a few individuals, the class of African entrepreneurs, who usually owned small-scale companies, were excluded from major economic activities on the coast. Unlike European businesses, Africans were specifically refused credit because of racist assumptions about African trustworthiness and lack of business acumen. Thus, not only political control, but economic control was key to the racialization process and the establishment of white supremacy on the African continent. It was imposed through a system of inequality based on racial difference that granted differential access to goods, services, property, opportunity, and identity. Independence from colonialism was supposed to change all of that. Decolonization was to mean the dismantling of both white supremacy and the concurrent tribal ethnic fragmentation that was nurtured by the colonial state in order to divide and conquer the natives into a constellation of tribes. Once dismantled, these projects, which is Europeanization and detribalization, would then allow for a more democratic post-colonial state, the strength of which would eventually enable African parity in the global political economy. With this decolonization agenda, for a new post-colonial independent Africa was never completed. The fact that African bodies replaced some European ones in the state political apparatus is often read as Africanization, the implication that African access to the political realm removed racialization as an important factor in the post-colonial social field. Yet the appropriation by Africans of certain political positions did not fully mean the erosion of the accumulated privileges of whiteness in the former colonies. Indeed, decolonization for Ghana was gradual, and it depended upon the retention of some of the most important structures of colonial rule. In this context, deracialization, would necessitate the full replacement of foreign business and industries, as well as the primarily European staff and economic advisors, local enterprises and staff. This could not be fully pursued. It was the same with another vestige of colonial rule, ethnic differentiation. This was neither reconfigured or dismantled in the making of the nation. In some cases, it was affirmed. As Mandani has argued, true decolonization in post-colonial Africa demanded no less than the full upward rooting of the bifurcated colonial structure, decoupling whiteness and power, which means a real de-whitening. However, this became a difficult task for Ghana and other post-colonial states, where once the colonial state's practices, and in particular its racial and social hierarchies, could be explicitly expressed as racial, the fact that the new state now had African political leadership meant that the government's practices could no longer be challenged in its mostly racial and anti-imperialist terms. This was the case even if certain state apparatuses still reflected white European foreign economic and political domination. Independence, therefore, ushered in a new moment during which the effective economic and specifically racial imbalance and white privilege of the colonial period was hidden beneath the new articulated Black and Pan-Africanist identity of the post-colonial state. Meanwhile, the new state's ideological promotion of Pan-African politics under Nkrumah further hid this discrepancy. In many respects, Nkrumah's and Ghana's early Pan-Africanism was explicitly racialist and was supposed to represent African renewal, ushering a new era of African self-determination and sovereignty. However, despite claims African sovereignty, the racialized social political, economic power of the colonial state proved impossible to extinguish. Consequently, the formation of a new Ghanaian post-colonial state was one more one. Institutional white power and privilege remained and were structured into the neo-colonial relationship of England and the West in general. And two, the Pan-Africanist ideals of the Nkrumah government were at best an ineffective, discursive, as opposed to concrete material, response to the structural post-colonial dilemma. For despite Nkrumah's denunciation of imperialism and his avowedly socialist statements, his actual policies were pragmatic and conciliatory. This is an important point to remember because it forces the question, what were the parameters of political and economic choice for this new African state? To begin with, Ghana's transition from colony to nation occurred through a long process that moved from what some call the diarchy beginning in 1951, when Nkrumah shared power with the British, to full independence in 1957. During this period, Nkrumah's position and relative power was fully dependent on British colonial authority and its associated administrative apparatus. The shared government worked with the white European staff conducting the majority of quotidian administrative details, an arrangement that, even with African members in the now integrated cabinets, ensured British control. But the shared period served to satisfy nationalist calls for African self-determination only by masking continued colonial control. In truth, the material and symbolic colonial apparatus remained in place. The process of decolonization, in effect, was designed to protect these institutions of colonial domination. The first way in which this was done was through the maintenance of the cultural and racial symbols of empire. The prestige and value of British rule prominently expressed through the formal spectacle of racialized white pomp and pageantry and the promotion and performance of European competence. The second protective measure of these institutions was through the parliamentary structure and party politics. With the colonial staff as the technical and intellectual tutors within the shared power arrangement, there was never a complete break from British influence. This was perhaps most crucial in the economic field. In particular, African decolonization worked not only to protect state and foreign companies from any radical challenge, but also to bring the commercial and bureaucratic bourgeoisie into alliance with imperialism. Then, in seeking the political kingdom, Nkrumah and his political party, the Convention People's Party, made compromises that reflected the contradictory nature and compromised position of a non-revolutionary transition mediated by and through the terms of the former colonial master. The gradual transfer of power to an imbalanced diarchy was contingent on the expertise of colonial staff and an assemblage of other white European expatriates, not only serving as consultants and advisors, but also the business elite who controlled broad sections of the country's extractive and trading, insurance, and banking economies. In this way, the British not only added to the force of their symbolic presence in the Gold Coast, they maintained their handle on material power, and they used this power as a bargaining tool against Ghanaian nationalist demands. In truth, British imperialism could seize the political kingdom in order to maintain the sustenance of economic domination. While Nkrumah was quite aware that political independence and economic dependence were incompatible, he took over a new Ghana that was economically a paradigmatic colonial society. The economy was extractive, dominated by one major crop. The other extracted raw materials, gold, diamonds, were under private foreign ownership. There were no industries. And because of the consolidation of European firms, along with the concomitant disenfranchisement of Ghanaian businesses during colonialism, foreign extractive firms fully controlled Ghana's businesses by independence. Indeed, 90% of import trade was controlled by foreign firms, 96% of timber concessions were owned by foreign firms, all of the country's gold mines and half of its diamond concessions were foreign owned, and banking and insurance were overwhelmingly dominated by foreign firms. Accordingly, the business community formed, and still forms, a pyramid structure with large multinational European firms at the top, medium-sized Indian, Lebanese, and Levantine businesses at the middle, and small-scale African traders in large number at the bottom. This institutional arrangement privileged white European and Levantine populations at the expense of Africans. And because these European multinational corporations were tapped into the global market, they often had more clout than the actual new Ghanaian independent state. The racial dimensions of this arrangement, while hardly a point of discussion for many scholars, are important to keep in mind when analyzing Nkrumah's government's attempt to both Africanize and industrialize New Ghana. In Nkrumah's Pan-Africanist vision, Ghana was to serve as a leader of a gradually industrializing Africa. This new radical development agenda meant complete independence of African control of both state and the economy. This was distinct from merely replacing European bodies with African ones, as Africanization sometimes narrowly implied. For Nkrumah, foreign expertise could be used as long as it led ultimately to full state control of political and economic enterprises. At the same time, the forces of neocolonialism were apparent in the ways that banking and commerce, in the existence of Western powers, were able to both manipulate the Ghanaian economy and influence local politics. And I discuss a specific case of this in my book, in terms of the Nkrumah government dealing with Kaiser Aluminum and the building of the Volta Dam. The new state's financial reserves and modern economy could not afford to undertake massive industrialization. In the absence of an effective local Ghanaian capitalist class to invest, and in the absence of an economic model outside of capitalism, the foreign private sector came to play a commanding role in Ghanaian economics. Thus, very early on, the new state's restrictive options and its own political strategies together placed it at the mercy of Western predators. Indeed, by the time of Nkrumah's fall in 1966 to a CIA-backed coup, foreigners dominated the large-scale ventures in the country. For his part, Nkrumah enabled, if not promoted, the Western, usually white expert in the pursuit of Ghana's industrialization. As a matter of no small importance, this dominance was also reflected in the racial politics tied to the issue of personnel working in these foreign enterprises. In the industrialization scheme, both state and foreign private firms often argued that the skilled workforce of the foreign investors was an attractive part of the deal. While the Gold Coast and later Ghana boasted one of the most highly educated and skilled populations on the African continent at the time of independence, by 1960, non-Ghanaians made up more than half of all the skilled workers employed by foreign firms. If we combine that percentage with the saturation of specifically white foreigners involved in Nkrumah's government and many industries, the numbers are staggering. Moreover, as business historian Stephanie Decker points out in her recent work on the political economy of decolonization, while the public sector had considerable local Ghanaian presence soon after independence, the private business sector had a significant white expatriate presence well into the 1990s and after. Africanization in the private sector was much slower than in civil service. At the same time, the new independent governments were reluctant to use legal means to coerce foreign companies to diversify their personnel, primarily for fear of capital flight. In addition, the foreign companies that did begin to diversify their sectors were primarily to appease new parties and in the most superficial ways. After Nkrumah, the Ghanaian post-colonial state, which is monocratic economy and depleted national currency reserves, confronted the international economy. Its weak positioning provided an opportunity for further encroachment from outside. The result is an externally defined structural adjustment that stressed more privatization by foreign Western companies, and which significantly recalled the racial imbalance that was civil society in the colonial period, and an externally managed kind of capital inflow that told the longest alongside a balance of white expatriates, according to UN estimates, now more than the colonial period. If there were alternatives to the expatriate technical and economic supremacy, they were not easy to define. The overwhelming constraints on effective de-racialization and the intended displacement of white European economic and political hegemony demonstrated the overall difficulties in establishing a fully independent nation that did not carry the vestiges of racialized colonialism, hence the racial predicament of decolonization. Towards the end of his rule, while Nkrumah was combating the implosion of his political party and rising local discontent, events such as the worldwide fall of the people crisis in 1965, the consequent shortage of foreign exchange, as well as a freeze of credit by Western financial institutions, which is, I guess, what's happening to Greece right now, and Cold War politics, quickly made the compromises of a shared power and Ghana's new colonial status apparent. Nkrumah felt increasingly entrapped by convergent complications in his plan to industrialize and fully decolonize. He came to rely more, as he felt these convergent complications, he came to rely more on the rhetoric of a radical pan-Africanism. But in this neo-colonial context, such calls to black racial solidarity against a renewed and white imperialism rang hollow. For despite its constricted options to redress the country's mounting problems, it was the supposed sovereign black Ghanaian state now, and not the colonial administration that was in charge. It would have to bear the burden of mass backlash. Perhaps a more important victory for neocolonialism was the fact that the reconsolidation of European power and influence on the ground were no longer treated as major culprits in any economic and political marginalization on a global scale. In this sense, the true victors in the decolonization experiment were European economic supremacy and structural racial privilege. One of the key consequences of the fall of Nkrumah's administration is that Pan-Africanism became less central to Ghanaians and African political practice and national ideology. With time, the acknowledgement of explicit links between continental African politics and global racialized inequality, specifically imperialism, were no longer being made. Two decades later, the Rawlings administration revived the memory of Pan-Africanism and replaced Nkrumah's explicit political Pan-Africanism with a distinctive neoliberal and depoliticized version. In the current climate, state rhetoric touts a successful, modern, and democratized Ghana by linking the struggle for self-determination with the advocacy of IMF-style market liberalization. Initially surrounded by radical leftist advisors, Rawlings was able to articulate an ideology of socialist economic principles and support internal social democratic forces, even as he pursued an antithetical economic and political agenda. At the same time, those who criticized the Rawlings government for continued economic downturn in the country were directly met with the response of Pan-Africanist rhetoric. Rawlings deflected blame from his administration's role in perpetuating Ghana's economic malaise by focusing on the reverential past and calling for African self-determination as well as an end to the continent's neo-colonial mentality. Pan-Africanism, as deployed by the Ghanaian post-colonial state, was thus used in a dual strategy. On the one hand, amid worsening economic conditions, it helped state officials explain the country's relative powerlessness in terms of both its position in the global political economy and the people's neo-colonial mentality. On the other hand, the focus on Ghana's history of Pan-Africanism and the development of heritage tourism were practical ways to generate income for the nation and to counter economic regression. Significantly, the anti-racist and anti-imperialist critiques are no longer part and parcel of this articulation. The racialized character of this economic and political dominance over minimally independent African countries has to be at the forefront of the analysis of the African post-colony, no less because current global relations have re-inscribed racial and cultural hierarchies between nations and regions. This is where we have to also recognize the failure of the African anti-colonial struggle in eradicating white supremacy and anti-blackness. Part two. W.E.B. Du Bois himself anticipated the contradictions that were confronted by an African liberation struggle in the face of economic necessity. In his address in 1958 All Africa People's Conference in Accra, he called for Africans to stand firm with their convictions in the face of economic pressure at independence. This is a quote. "The West offers to let some of your smarter and less scrupulous leaders become fellow capitalists with the white exploiters, if in turn they induce the nation's masses to pay the awful cost. Strive against it with every fiber of your body and soul. A body of local private capitalists, even if they are black, can never free Africa. They will simply sell it into new slavery to old masters overseas." End quote. What would Du Bois make of the contemporary legacy of his Pan-Africanism as manifest through private investment and cultural forms in modern-day Ghana? What would he say about the tragic and unrelenting anti-blackness on a global scale, and in particular its impact on continental Africans in the post-colonial moment. What would Nkrumah say? More generally, what does Pan-Africanism mean in the current context of racial capitalism and a reckless US empire? Does it still hold possibilities for liberational politics around globalized racial oppression? We may be able to begin to find answers to these questions by going back to the Dubuque E.B. Du Bois Memorial Center for Pan-African Culture. To visit the Du Bois Memorial Center in Accra over the past 20 years, at least for me, is to witness the painful decay of the memory of the E.B. Du Bois and of the Pan-Africanism and self-determination that the cadre of Black radicals so forcefully advocated. This once grand house, which was the ultimate representation of Pan-African intellectual and political triumph, now stands decrepit. It is barely maintained, in desperate need of paint, as rotting wood, and its collection of Du Bois books, documents, and memorabilia is slowly disappearing, while what is left is dusty and mildewed. This, despite the fact that the place remains a popular tourist destination. The same fate has befallen the George Padmore Pan-African Library and the Kwame Nkrumah Mausoleum. While there is much blame to go around, from the lack of funds to general state and international neglect, the distressed condition of these memorials to Pan-Africanism are more than symbolic. Against this, consider that less than a block away from the dilapidated Du Bois Memorial Center is the brand new, sleek, and fortified U.S. Embassy. A huge compound that stretches for blocks is guarded by the U.S. military and serves as a base, as one of the bases of the U.S. Empire in that part of the world. Consider that this embassy was commissioned in 2005 when the U.S. Secretary of State, the U.S. Ambassador to Ghana, the Director of the U.S. Overseas Building Operations for African Americans. But most importantly, consider the current blackface providing cover for U.S. Empire, who has militarized U.S. engagement with the African continent, and who, during his trip to Ghana, both channeled Pan-Africanism and employed the racialist language of empire to chastise Africans about their supposed misplaced antagonism towards the brutal legacies of colonialism. It is in this context that the radical international anti-imperialist vision of early Pan-Africanism must be recovered. Conceived as both an idea and movement, Pan-Africanism is a complex set of practices that represent a wide range of articulation and affirmation of international Black politics and culture. Emerging against the context of European imperialism and the consequent exploitation of Africans on the continent and in the diaspora, Pan-Africanism sought both the vindication and liberation of Blacks. In its most radical formulation, the project Pan-Africanism insisted on complete emancipation, cultural, political, and economic, with shifting objectives to change the contingencies of the Black experience. It is both an intellectual tradition and a praxis of liberation, and the anti-colonial movement was one of its central components. But I want to follow scholar Anthony Williams in making the argument that as a response to racial terror and exploitation, Pan-Africanism is also one articulation of what Cedric Robinson calls the Black radical tradition. The Black radical tradition is first an appreciation for the long history of resistance of populations of African descent. But it's a resistance that takes liberation as its vision and its subject, the Black. The conceptualization of the Black radical tradition was put forth by scholar Cedric Robinson in his remarkable book, Black Marxism. Black Marxism is first and foremost a critique of mainstream Marxism for its preoccupation with the European working class experience, centering it as a default experience of the laboring masses. Relatedly, it is also a critique of the absence of race analysis in Marxism. Consequently, Robinson presented the idea of racial capitalism. He explains this by interrogating the very formation of Europe and the fact that its economic and political foundations depended upon racial othering and exclusion. Through this understanding, it becomes clear that as the key economic foundation of European imperialism, capitalism, based on the slave trade and Africans and the exploitative colonial rule, is always already raised. What is most important for Robinson, however, is the resistance and reclamation of the exploited human, the Black subject objects that bear the brunt of capitalist exploitation and European imperialism. Europe created a worldview in which black people were a contradiction, inhuman, human, dehumanized human. Despite these conditions, the history of black radicalism is incessant. Robinson explains that for the period between the mid-16th century and mid-19th centuries, it was an African tradition that grounded collective resistance by blacks to slavery and colonial imperialism. It is indeed the ongoing quest for African peoples to assert their humanity over the long history of this racialized capitalist exploitation that is truly revolutionary. In other words, the idea that black lives matter, African lives matter, has been part and parcel of this black radical tradition. As scholars, our intellectual, indeed moral imperative is to interrogate this tradition and make it authentic.
Very much, Jamila, and we will meet again in the same place for the closing event at 6 in the afternoon. And for those who come, the meeting, the last meeting at the Fondation Cartier. Thank you very much.